Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Today on our show, we talk to Princeton professor emeritus Harry G. Frankfurt about his book On Inequality. His last book was called On Bullshit. I dare you to bleep that, KPFK Bleepmeister. It's in the title. You can't bleep the fucking title. Magdalena Edwards is here. She's a LARB editor. She's going to tell us about Brazilian author Clarice Lispector. Or is it Clarice? Or is it Clarice? We'll clarify how to pronounce it. LARB editrix Sarah Mesley is going to stop by to talk to us about an essay Jedediah Purdy published in LARB about Elena Ferrante and Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Fantastic essay.
Our old friend BJ Novak is in the green room and ready to go. He brought a live monkey with him. I think it's a bonobo. He's really trying not to get bummed, Tom.
He looks very handsome today. Did you see him? He's very dapper. He's wearing like
bonobo.
But joining me are my co-hosts, my usual co-conspirators, the founding editor of LARB, UC professor Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Hey, Seth. UC Riverside, that is.
And my other co-host, she is the fiction editor at LARB, former drama critic, writer, working on a book about Oscar Hammerstein, not Stein. Stein, not Steen. Laurie, can we get some Oscar Hammerstein? Laurie Weiner. Hello, Laurie.
Hi, Seth.
Joining us today is a special guest, unchained from her desk at the Los Angeles Review of Books, LARB editrix, Slayer of Dragons, former Miss Universe contestant Magdalena Edwards is here to talk about Clarice Lispector, who, despite what you may be thinking, is not the lead character on the next season of True Detective.
That's what I thought.
It sounds like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's so funny. And also, I just want to say that Magdalena, as lovely as she is, was not a contestant for a Miss Universe.
Could have been.
Absolutely, but we did make that up. I just want, for the record,
welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, Magdalena.
Thank you. Truth only here.
Only.
And Clarice Lispector is having a bit of a revival.
Yes, she is.
But a lot of us had not heard of her much before this revival.
Well, she is a Brazilian writer, born in the Ukraine in 1920. Her family moved to Brazil when
Bad year to be born in the Ukraine.
Exactly. So they had to leave, and they moved before she was a year old. They ended up in Brazil, and that is why she is one of the most important 20th century Brazilian writer. And in the last couple of years, there has been a new set of translations coming out of New Directions, helmed by Benjamin Moser, who wrote her biography. Also, Benjamin Moser really is a preacher. He is a preacher of all things Clarice.
Yes.
And he is a mover and a shaker, and he goes about the world. And this is important. You know, translators do this kind of work. Writers do this kind of work. And a dead writer certainly needs this kind of ambassador. And he's very loud.
He's a real P.T. Barnum for her, right? I mean, he's calling us all into the tent.
He conjures her, actually.
Yeah, but if you call him a P.T. Barnum, it sounds like he's making shit up.
That's not the right thing, is it? But he's a serious proselytizer for her, active proselytizer.
But let's talk a little bit about her biography, because I think it is such an extraordinary life.
So they moved to Brazil, to the northeastern part of Brazil. And by the time Clarice was 9, her mother had passed away. And if you pay attention to the mothers and the children in the stories, this is an important theme. What the mother is doing, what the mother can or cannot do, how the children engage with the mother, and how this kind of maternal love works.
Would you read a little bit of her work?
Absolutely. I want to read the first couple paragraphs of her short story, The Smallest Woman in the World. It's also been translated by Giovanni Ponteiro. And now by Katrina Dodson. I'm going to read Katrina's translation from the new Complete Stories.
This is The Smallest Woman in the World.
That's right. A menor mulher do mundo. Nas profundezas da África Equatorial, o explorador francês Marcel Prêtre, caçador e homem do mundo, topou com uma tribo de pigmeus de uma pequeneza surpreendente. Mais surpresa. Clarice's Portuguese is unique. And it can be strange. She plays with grammar. She plays with making tiny changes where you might think this is correct or typical, but then it's not, and it's not. And so there's this play with language that some translators have smoothed over, and Katrina Dodson's translation definitely does not do that. In the depths of equatorial Africa, the French explorer Marcel Prêtre, hunter and man of the world, came upon a pygmy tribe of surprising smallness. He was all the more surprised then when informed that an even smaller people existed beyond forests and distances. So deeper still he plunged. In the central Congo, he indeed discovered the smallest pygmies in the world. And, like a box within a box within a box, among the smallest pygmies in the world was the smallest of the smallest pygmies in the world, obeying, perhaps, the need nature sometimes has to outdo herself. Amid mosquitoes and trees warm with moisture, amid the rich leaves of the laziest green, Marcel Prêtre came face to face with a woman who stood 18 inches tall, full-grown, black, silent. Dark as a monkey, he would inform the press, and that she lived in the top of a tree with her little consort. In the tepid, wild mists which swell the fruits early and make them taste almost intolerably sweet, she was pregnant.
I want to know more.
Yeah, you know, there's something about, and this is, I think, my experience of reading her in general, is that it's not exactly allegory that she's touching on. There's some relation, and it reminds me of, you know, the Amy Bender's technique and people who are on the edge of some other, some new form, which is not fairy tale. It's not fantasy. It's not science fiction. It's not,
it's not the
allegory,
Bible.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's something else.
She has been compared to Kafka, and Kafka very much comes to mind. It's like some kind of, you know, other world, but recognizable, and people are being used as symbols. And
I think that the stories vary. She wrote and published stories throughout her life. But I do agree that this voice that sort of conjures and connects the dots of reality in a way that you wouldn't have thought to connect before, that is consistent.
Why do you think when South American writers first came to prominence in North America, I'm thinking of the late 1970s when Vargas Llosa and Garcia Marquez and other writers from that part of the world became better known to serious readers here, she did not?
Partly because it's Portuguese, not Spanish, right?
Right. And even among the Spanish-speaking countries, you don't have a unified publishing world.
Do you think it had anything to do with the fact that she was female?
I don't particularly think so. I mean, I think she's always had a consistent reception in Brazil.
From the
very beginning. From the very beginning.
She was announced as the savior of Brazilian literature with her first book.
And now she herself was in an accident in 1966 when she was in her 40s, and then she spent the last 10 years of her life in physical pain, apparently, and died, you know, young,
in her 50s.
Was that reflected, that the idea of physical pain?
Well, I think that the body and the pain and suffering the body can undergo is something that you see throughout. I mean, if you think also about what happened with her mother.
Right.
You know, it was always in her mind. But yes, it is true that you have women who age over the course of the work, and you see that in the short stories. And I think it's also very interesting that she died on December 9th, 1977, so a day before she was going to turn 57. That's kind of an interesting bookend. And a circle.
Yeah.
Clarice would have her life in that, you know, in a perfect circle.
The author is Clarice Lispector. Magdalena Edwards, thanks for coming in to talk to us about her.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Harry G. Frankfurt is a professor of philosophy emeritus at Princeton and the author of several books. His most recent one is called On Inequality, in which he offers the provocative theory that perhaps we shouldn't be so worried about economic inequality. It's very timely, and he's here to discuss it with us. Welcome, Harry Frankfurt.
Thank you very much.
In your book, you refer to the moral innocence of economic inequality, which is a phrase I love, and you posit that economic inequality is not morally objectionable. Bernie Sanders and his followers would certainly disagree with you. I'd like it if you would elaborate on your theory to get us going.
economic inequality is morally objectionable, but not in itself. It's morally objectionable because of the consequences or things that go along with it. Inequalities of power and influence and status leads to a disproportionate influence of certain areas, certain elements in society, and that's objectionable. The fact that some people have more than others, as long as everybody has enough, doesn't seem to me to be particularly morally interesting.
But if somebody doesn't have enough money, that's a problem.
That's the problem. It's not that they don't have as much as the other guys, that they don't have enough for themselves.
Right. And do you think that it's got any chance of making a difference?
Not much, no.
Well, but see, I think that your book on bullshit actually seems to have made an impact.
It had an impact. I'm not sure it made any difference.
There seems to be a lot of it around yet.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, I think that the discourse changed, and I assume it's not an entire coincidence that in the decade since you published that book, it's at its 10th anniversary now, the whole kind of satire about truthiness from Colbert has become part of the way people respond to political events and political discourse.
Maybe. I don't really know. I don't notice that much or any difference in the way people respond to the kind of bullshit we get during a presidential campaign that we're having now. The need or the impulse or the craving to engage in bullshit is so powerful. I hope you're right, and I think that perhaps in the long run it will make a difference. I would like to think that it could make a difference, not so much in the amount of bullshit that's produced, but in the readiness of people to accept it. People object to lying. Somebody is caught in a lie, there's a big commotion about that. It's hard to talk about anybody being caught in bullshit because it's not an offense. It's not regarded as objectionable. Well, in a way, it's objectionable, but it's not regarded as a felony the way lying would be.
One of the most crystalline thoughts you expressed in your book on bullshit was, for me, the distinction you made between bullshit and lying.
What I said in the book, I think, was that the liar is not an... he still cares about the truth. He's just against it. but it means something to him. Whereas the bullshit artist doesn't care whether it's true or false. You know, I just use the term bullshit artist. After I wrote that book, somebody suggested to me, maybe it was my own thought, that I should write a series of books on deformities of the truth. Lying, bullshit, spin was another. So what's the difference between spin and bullshit? Here's one difference. We talk about spin doctors and bullshit artists. Now, what does that mean? Bullshit is more creative, as an artist is. Spin doctor is not creative. He's sort of adjusting things.
A technician.
Harry, you make a point of saying that the book I'm talking about on inequality is an exegesis and shouldn't be used as a political cudgel.
Right.
But not a close reading of it, but a light reading of it would lead someone to think that it could be employed by certain right-wing elements as high-minded justification for their limited government views. And how do you respond to that, and what would you say to people who might think to do that, because they're out there and they're...
Yeah, my wife is worried about that. You know, I was a friend of Bob Nozick. I don't know if that name means anything to you, but he was a very brilliant young philosopher. He died quite young. But he wrote a book called Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which made him a kind of darling of the right. And he would get invitations to speak to right-wing groups and to be endorsed by them. He was very embarrassed by it because he didn't belong to the right. Now, the Los Angeles Times published an excerpt of the book a month or two ago. I immediately got a number of emails not from people I knew, but from people who were professional philosophers, academic philosophers, all of them condemning the book, and all of them explicitly or obviously people on the left. Mm-hmm. And I understand what you're saying, that I can understand how the book could be read that way.
Now, you wrote some of this almost 30 years ago?
Yeah, 30, 35, yeah. Something like that.
And is it always true for you that you can write something 35 years ago and read it again and find that it remains as true for you? Because I find that I write something 11 minutes ago and I reread it and I think, that doesn't sound right to me anymore.
Yeah, but you probably have your eye on a different topic. My eye is on the meaning of concepts. That doesn't change. The concepts have an eternal existence. They're created by definitions, and the definitions are stable.
Now, is that actually true? The concept of honor, has that remained stable? seems to me that our sense of honor is not exactly Odysseus's.
What I'm thinking of is the Socratic Platonic tradition, that what philosophy is concerned with is the clarification of ideas. Mm-hmm. And if you want to clarify an idea, you want to clarify that idea. The words that are used to convey that idea may change, but the idea that you're interested in clarifying is created. It exists in virtue of a definition, and the definition is always that definition. It may no longer define anything. It may be that the thing that it was trying to define no longer exists. That's quite possible. So the kind of honor that the Homeric poems are concerned with, there may no longer be such a thing. So that the concept of honor no longer has any application. But it's the same concept.
To get back to equality, I want to bring the discussion back to that subject. One of the lines in the book that really jumped out at me was, the doctrine of equality contributes to the moral disorientation and shallowness of our time. That's an incredibly provocative thing to say.
I want to say first that one of the readers of the manuscript that the press sent it to in order to evaluate it wrote back, among other things, that he thought that that sentence was worth the price of admission in itself.
It's one of the best sentences in the book.
Yeah. I was thinking of people who care about equality, who care about whether they have the same as other people, whether there are people richer than they are, and whether they have exactly the same things that other people have. One of the main points that I wanted to make in the book was that that kind of attitude, that kind of concern, that sort of preoccupation diverts people from what I think is really much more important. What do they need? Not what other people have or what other people may need, but what do they need? So it diverts them from understanding themselves. And that's where I get the idea that it's responsible for some of the shallowness and disorientation of our time.
Well, the book is on inequality. Our guest has been Harry Frankfurt. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM.
So this is Sarah Messley, and I got a happy email from my good friend Jed saying, "Sarah, I've been thinking about Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ferrante. What if I wrote something?" And I sort of had an extreme jazz hand moment. Like, yes. It was one of those things where something that had been coexistent in my life, everybody seemed to be talking about both of those things, but separately, all of a sudden came together.
And by Jed, you mean...
I mean Jedediah Purdy, who is the author of several books, most recently the Pulitzer Prize-nominated After Nature, A Politics of the Anthropocene.
And who happens to be on the phone with us.
Yes.
What a coincidence.
Yeah. What a coincidence.
Hello, Jed.
Hi, everyone.
And Jed, you had a sense that these two figures had something to do with each other. Did you know what you were going to write when you got started?
I was trying to work out a fixation that I had with both of the figures. When I said at the beginning of the essay that I was trying to understand how they had occupied and arrested our attention, and I was definitely alluding to the insurgent Occupy movement and to the state power of the police. When I said occupy and arrest, there was this sense that they had really come in both from above and below and taken over my mind, kind of like an insurgency, kind of like a crackdown. And I wanted to understand that. So I felt convinced that there was something there and that it was exactly in the way that both of these books were sort of were resistant to an easy identification, resistant to letting you feel like, oh, this is my book. And yet, nonetheless, everyone I talked to felt like these were their books and the books of the moment and books to which their relationship really mattered, even though they were not books that particularly invited that and actually in some ways refused that.
I think there's a French phrase to describe singing that's like on vif something, but it's like it means a voice on a blade, like the voice that cuts you open, that sounds like it's cut open, that, you know, Edith Piaf is the famous exemplar of.
Well, also, you know, we get, as Americans, I think, become obsessed with the redemption narrative, and neither the Coates book, and I haven't read the Ferrante Trilogy plus one, but I've read Days of Abandonment, and in Between the World and Me and Days of Abandonment, there isn't an ounce of redemption. There are stringent And I would say, I would go as far as saying the Coates book is a little hopeless, I think, in terms of his outlook, which I found very disturbing. And like Sarah was referring to the idea of reading it on a razor, that's very much what it felt like. And boy, he does not anticipate any kind of redemption down the road.
For a long time with the Coates book, as in a matter of weeks, I was struggling with exactly that hopelessness. I was talking to friends who understood that to be a kind of failing in Coates and a kind of sign of decline of thinking and sort of political critique from the time of Baldwin to now. And what I ended up realizing, this was sort of a key thing in putting the essay together with Sarah, is that Coates has to be understood as working in conditions in which the language of redemption, which has had such a powerful hold on the American racial imagination, at least since the civil rights movement of the 20th century, the Second Reconstruction, and maybe longer, is in a state of severe abuse and decay. On the one hand, the Supreme Court is using the language of Brown v. Board of Education and the language of King's I Have a Dream speech to make the case for invalidating affirmative action as a violation of constitutional equal protection. And King and Frederick Douglass have both become icons of the right as much as of the left, opportunistically, but you know, nonetheless. And Barack Obama's language about how we are the people we've been waiting for is this sort of like maxing out of the redemption language, using up all the fuel that was there, and yet here we are, still waiting for ourselves, you could say. So I think that Coates is trying to, in a way, reconstruct the language of candid personal description of how race and structural injustice feel on the body and feel as lived in a way that has to put those rudiments back together before anything sweeping can be said.
I think in Coates' book, the problem he had with hope was it felt corny to him.
Yeah.
Really. Right? And he and cheap, almost two-dimensional.
I think it's a mandatory ending. It's like a genre obligation of a certain kind of public speech that feels very hollow right now. I'm sorry, I'm just enthusiastically chiming in with your point, Seth.
No, that's exactly right. That's perfectly put. That kind of speech constructed for public consumption that we've been consuming at least since 1963 when Dr. King's speeches began to get a lot of attention. And I think he's very overtly rejecting that kind of narrative. And it's what made the book so astringent and in many ways so powerful.
I think that you have very clearly identified a moment, which is, and it's been incredibly interesting to link Coates and Ferrante. But what my question for you is, in the great tradition of American liberalism or progressivism, is the idea that, and you know, it's in the Dream speech, and in order to get to a better world, to achieve a better world, one has to imagine a better world. One has to be willing to imagine it and believe in it in order to achieve it. And that's been, you know, the great slogan and hallmark of the American dream. And now, so we're at this moment now where perhaps you or Coates or Ferrante or all of you are saying, you know, that is no longer the fuel behind what's going to take us to the next level. That's something, but I do have to ask, because I'm sure lots of people are, is it a moment, and how useful is it to say, you know, hope and dreaming is no longer going to get us to the next level? I mean, what else is there? I mean,
I really appreciate that question. I think,
Jed, can you answer that question for us? Because we really kind of need an answer to that question as a society.
And we need it now.
This afternoon would be nice.
Right. Yeah. If you could just...
I do have an answer to that question, actually. I don't say this in the essay, but I think that the redemptive tradition has mistaken the relationship between hope and action in a way that's very significant, or at least it's given a formulation of the relationship between the two that is not the only possible one. And its formulation is that you need hope in order to act, that you need to be able to see a better world in order to move toward it. An alternative formulation is that action precedes hope. Action precedes hope because it's only action that reveals what the actual constraints and the actual give in your circumstances are. And it's only when you've pressed against them in that way that you can find out what other directions and even worlds might be possible. So if that's right, it leaves open the question of what it is that moves us to act without hope in the sense of a clear path in advance to a better world. And I think the answer there is solidarity. The answer is the people we care for and even love that we're acting with. And that is something that never falls away from Coates' story. And it's part of the reason that I don't think of the book as gratuitously or definitively bleak, even though I think bleakness is a pervasive note in it.
So in other words, this has been really fun, Jed. Thanks so much.
Some cheerful subjects on a Monday afternoon.
Thanks to Harry G. Frankfurt for coming in, Magdalena Edwards, Sarah Mesley. Once again, our apologies to BJ Novak. We ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week. Laura, do you think he'll really come back this time? I think we're trying his patience.
We are trying his patience, but I gave him some candy, and he said he would come back.
Well, fingers crossed. Occasionally on this show, we endorse other podcasts. And today, Tom and Lori, we are giving a shout-out to The Catapult.
Love The Catapult.
The Catapult is a podcast of the best new writing read aloud. It's like a reading series, only untethered from time and space. Every 2 weeks, you can hear new fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers you love in exciting new voices. So check out The Catapult. Put it in your podcast diet. We think it's cool. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin, our crack production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano, our czar of scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld, and of course, the irreplaceable Sid Biggs, without whom we could never do this show. And also, before I forget, the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation enables us to come back week after week, and we are grateful. Speaking of the Goldhirsch Foundation, they are doing a thing called LA 2050, where they are giving away a ton of money to organizations who are meant to be reshaping the future of Los Angeles. LARB was a finalist last year. Right now, we are number two in the voting. There are only days left. Tom, how many days exactly?
Voting ends Tuesday at noon.
Go to the LARB site. On the top right corner, you can see what to click on. If you click on that, it's a vote for us. We would really love to get this grant. It goes to writers and artists in LA. If it happens, you can be a part of it. For Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, this is Seth Greenland. Thanks for listening. See you next week.